If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the divine love and light of the Supreme Beloved. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command, Cosmic Pep Talks for Closet Christ. This evening, our seminar topic is Changes and Adversity Forge Destiny. And My Life in the Circus. So, if you're ready, take a deep breath and call yourself present in your whole light beingness. Allow that great presence that you are beyond this body, beyond this lifetime, beyond this name and form. Allow that greater you to enter your full awareness and anchor itself throughout your entire physical body and human personality. Take another deep breath and flood every cell of your being with who you truly are. Ready? Bring it down and right out through your feet. Anchor that divinity. Open your eyes. Anchor that light. You are the light. You are the divine presence. You are the love of God that is only made tangible in time and space through the human form. You alone have been given the authority to speak for God and as God. Now, if that isn't a divine destiny and calling, I don't know what would be. So it's 9/23/2015, and tremendous surchargings of energy are impacting our planet. And energy is just energy. It is our consciousness that directs its manifestation for good or ill. And for this, we are individually and collectively responsible as to the outcome. We have two eclipses this month, Wave X, four blood moons, a Shemitah year of Jubilee, the Jewish New Year, Yom Kippur, the CERN, absolutely fired to its ultimate max. We have the festival of the Divine Mother in India. We've just had Lord Ganesha's birthday, the removal of the one who removes obstacles from our path, and many prophecies and prognostications. We have the Pope's visit now. He is in Philadelphia. Today he went to Washington, D.C., and was a guest in the White House and spoke with the President. He's addressing Congress. He's going to speak at the UN before the General Assembly. These things have never happened before. This is humongous. And the fact that this Pope is totally out of the box in terms of his personal consecration to ministering and serving to the poor, following very much in the footsteps of his namesake, Saint Francis. So, God is present and all is well. Just with the Pope's visit alone, billions of people, there are at least a billion or more Catholics worldwide, and billions of these people are watching what happens with the Pope. Whether they're Catholic or not, everyone is very fascinated with what's going to happen as a result of what he says and how that's going to affect, and hopefully it will, the policies and the direction that we're taking as people and a nation. So consider this. There's not one thing taking place in your life or on this planet or in the universe that hasn't already been worked out and resolved beyond time in the eternal now. It's all a done deal. It's simply the revisiting and the rehashing of what's already present. Our challenge, however, is to raise our consciousness into the place where that can be experienced as so. And one way that life assists us in the raising of our consciousness is to disrupt our status quo, to radically shift our attention, and thus our consciousness through sudden changes and often adversity. So, why is it that out of the field of infinite potentialities, only certain things manifest? Why is that? Well, I was shown that it is due to three principles of manifestation. These are a bit esoteric, so bear in with me, if you will. The first is magnetization, which operates like a magnet. Magnetizing gradually draws into our life the vibratory equivalent of our attention and focus of energy. Number two, potency. This energy becomes empowered or potentized by the sustained nurturing of our attention and intention. We both draw to us and empower whatever ultimately manifests in our life, and that's both individually and collectively. We draw those things into our life which then precipitate, which means to move from the formless state of idea into material form. And this is called precipitation. Precipitation takes place as a natural occurrence, resulting from one sustained magnetizing and potentizing of energy. Now, these simple laws of nature explain how we create our own destiny, personally and collectively, and why certain things come into being while other things do not, even though we have unlimited potential, divinely speaking. We could move our spiritual inner awareness into one accord with any particular state, and if held consistently enough, that would precipitate. Now, you place that same principle out upon the collective humanity, and given each person's individual mindset, beliefs, proclivity, karmic field, etc., it's like corralling cats, trying to get them into one accord. And there's only one who can do that, and that's the Divine Spirit. So the Divine Spirit is being poured forth on all flesh at this time, and gradually people are waking up, believe it or not. People are actually awakening and responding in all different ways to this surcharging of energy. But overall, it's a good thing. Overall, we are seeing a shifting of consciousness that we have spoken of as the paradigm shift or the shift of the ages. So many have heard the phrase, he must have the Midas touch, because everything he touches turns to gold. We may know of someone, maybe it's you, where everything you do seems to turn out well. You are living what I would call a grace-wrapped life, or others would call a charmed life. You may also have known others where the opposite seems to be the case. So the world would use such phrases as he or she was born under a lucky star of good fortune, or under stars that are ill-aspected, or simply that they are lucky or unlucky. The wise, however, know that there's no such thing as good or bad luck, that everything occurs due to natural laws that are set into motion by that individual or that nation. In the East, this is commonly referred to as one's karma, the natural consequences that result from our every thought, word, and deed. In the West, however, we tend to think that we can somehow get ahead without exerting the necessary effort, self-discipline, and focus. Many are quick to adopt any get-rich-quick scheme that shows up, while others pay big bucks running to various psychics and fortune tellers, hoping they will somehow unlock their grand destiny. People also use various forms of divination, tarot cards, pendulums, crystal balls, Ouija boards, etc., all in the hope of discovering and unlocking their future destiny and fortune. And yet, every form of psychic divination only taps into one's own predominant thought and desire patterns. In other words, one's existing energy field, or aura, governs what shows up in divination. Still, people believe that the psychic has really seen and somehow confirmed what has already been in one's auric field. That doesn't mean it will manifest. It depends on what you do with the energy. If you sit like a bump on the log, nothing's going to manifest. But no one wants to be told that you alone create your life, your future, and your destiny out of your present lifestyle and focus of attention. Who wants to hear that, right? And yet it's so simple to know your future, for it will be a repeat of today, unless you shift your focus and change your way of thinking and operating. Unless you do that, things will remain pretty much the same for you. That is why throughout the ages, people who have lived phenomenal lives have had to make a radical departure from their former way of living. Some go on vision quests. Others travel abroad, go on retreats, or go to ashrams in India. Now, some leave home at an early age, and that's what I did. I left home at the age of 13 and joined a circus family of bareback riders as an apprentice. Probably most of you have never seen a bareback rider because it's almost an obsolete art form now. But it's those ladies that used to be dressed in ballerina tutus that would stand on top of the beautiful white percheron horses and do somersaults and vault on and off and so forth and so on and jump through hoops and all of that. And so that's a bareback rider. So I spent my teenage years as a circus performer. I did all kinds of circus arts. I used to slide down a high wire that was slanted, and I would hang by my teeth and slide down that slanted wire as fast as I could. It was called the slide for life. I used to do several different types of aerial acts. I was a member of the Wolinda family in the sense that I performed with them, because they were intermarried with the riding act that I was a performer in. So we kind of formed one family of the Zope Wolindas. But the very first act that I performed with was from England, and it was called the Poodles Hannaford family. And Poodles Hannaford was a very, very famous comedic writer from the Hippodrome in London, and later became an actor in Hollywood. And so they were very, in themselves, extremely interesting people. The Zope family had had their own European single-ring circus. They were from Vittorio Veneto in Italy. And they didn't speak any English hardly at all, so I learned to speak Italian very quickly. And I had a very interesting time because you had Mama Zope, who was, my gosh, she must have been in her 80s at that point, had birthed 16 children, of which only 5 lived, and cracked the whip like a ringmaster in keeping us all in line, because she traveled with us, and her son, and her daughter, and her cousin's children. You might have seen us perform. We were in Super Circus, and we performed many, many times. Excuse me, I meant to say the Big Top. And we performed many times on Al Dole Bridges, Super Circus, Ed Sullivan, and other shows that were popular in the 50s. It was 1952 when I joined the circus, and I left to go to the university in 1959. So my teenage years, the masters must have kept me out of mischief by keeping me involved in the circus. I was too busy trying to survive the rigors of circus life to really get into any mischief whatsoever. which reminds me, one of my many adventures as a circus performer was experiencing the Cuban Revolution, which erupted in Havana January 1st, 1959. I had been performing for a couple months that fall in 1958 in the Circo Nacional de Cuba, which was held in a gorgeous domed amphitheater that resembled a spaceship. It was a wondrous show with three rings of colored sawdust, flashing colored lights, showgirls from the Copacabana Review, and I was performing with the Alberto Zoppé bareback riding family and the Carl Wallenda family of high wire fame. The morning we awakened and found, instead of a usually very peaceful and happy atmosphere, we awakened to total chaos and hell. Overnight, Fidel Castro had marched into Havana with his troops and taken over Havana. The former leader, Bautista, had been ousted, and we were suddenly thrust into the middle of a war zone, with our hotel transformed into a fort. At one point, I remember standing on the toilet to peek out the small window in our bathroom, and a bullet whizzed over my head. The first day, someone came around to our rooms with a bucket of boiled wieners, and that was the last of our food. We were trapped in our hotel rooms for over a week. As I was embedded within an Italian circus troupe, I escaped detection, so I was the last American to be airlifted out of Cuba and returned to the USA. My father, an army colonel, was absolutely at his wit's end trying to get me out of Cuba. All unbeknownst to me, because as a young kid, I didn't know revolution from anything, and I was just enjoying flirting with the cute Cuban guys. What can I tell you? But as a young teenager, I saw firsthand the entire destiny of a nation and her people dramatically change overnight. So as I watched Pope Francis a couple days ago conduct Mass from Revolution Square, I recognized that same square where our hotel had been located. And I even thought I recognized the hotel building as the camera panned the location. Wow, all of these years, people had been denied freedom of religious expression ever since Fidel Castro came into power that day in 1959. And they were hungry for God. They were there in their, probably up to a million people were there, crowded to hear and to witness what was for many their first exposure to a Catholic Mass. Amazing. And now, as an old and ailing man, Fidel warmly was shown greeting Pope Francis, as did his brother, the present head of Cuba, Raul Castro. And there was a new feeling of hope and openness. And both men leaned into the Pope eagerly, gesticulating with their hands and expressing openness and eagerness to exchange. And a new era was obviously dawning. and with it, hopefully, a brighter future for the Cuban people and nation. The talk delivered by Pope Francis could have, word for word, been given by Sai Baba, as the same call to selfless, loving service was sounded. The call to cherish and care for one another as brothers and sisters, and to create a new revolution of tenderness, kindness, and compassion. It was literally soul-stirring. The Cuban Revolution is an example of how stagnant complacency is often disrupted by some life-altering event. The recent fires in California, which have destroyed close to 2,000 homes and businesses and a whole town. One can only pray that out of the ashes of such devastation, new lives will arise like the phoenix. That's what I'm praying for. Thus, one's own higher nature or soul will oft-times orchestrate such radical upheavals to shift people and nations into a higher destiny. The Syrian refugees, left homeless by the thousands, pressing into new territory, trying to find an opening, a home, a place to recreate their lives, to right now survive. These people are facing such a massive upheaval now. The massive persecution of Christians in Iraq and other places. I don't think we've had such massive, catastrophic persecution of Christians ever. And it's well known that out of such persecution, tremendous revival takes place. Tremendous revival. And so we pray, out of the shed blood and the shattered lives and the destitution and desperation of millions of people worldwide, new lives will be birthed. New vision, new alliances. It's like a global diaspora now. You know, we had the horrific disruption of life in Kathmandu, Nepal. The horrific devastation that was wrought on the Tibetan nation by the Chinese. The Irish potato famine, which probably caused some of my ancestors to immigrate to America. The diaspora of the Jewish people. The aftermath of the Civil War. And on and on and on. Each saw new lives being born out of these and other national upheavals. Even 9/11 gave us as a nation an enormous kick in the butt to wake up. The day you start edging God out and living totally motivated by the greedy, selfish, self-flattering, and self-seeking lower nature, you have spelled a very dire future for yourself. And so we have to have these wake-up calls. Otherwise, we're going to keep betting on the stock market. We're going to keep doing our mindless, stupid pastimes. I heard tell from one employer that it was a common practice to entertain clients by sometimes spending up to $10,000 or more dollars a night for lap dancers. Hello, if that isn't degradation, I don't know what is. If that isn't rampant stupidity and unconscious behavior, I don't know what else you would call it. But we have to wake up. We have to get with the plan. We have to get back into alignment with a divine plan that has as its overall a destiny to birth a Satya Yuga, a age, a golden age of truth, that the Vedas say will last for 10,000 years. That's what we're here to do. That's what we're here to precipitate. That's what we're here to magnetize and potentize by our use of present energy resources that we have in our lives right now. Are you part of that? Or are you part of the group that sits on the sidelines and points fingers of blame and wags tongues of criticism and tells tales of dire things that are supposed to happen according to some feverish ego brains, ego minds? Are you part of that crowd? Are you lending energy and fuel to the worst case possible outcomes for humanity? Or are you part of a global team that wants to see us birth into an entirely new way of being? Oh, it's so easy to say this, but if you don't take personal stock of your life, your use of energy, and what you're magnetizing into your field, and how you're utilizing the energy resources that you have right now to create for yourself a divine manifestation of destiny, of the highest divine destiny, then what are you doing? Why are you occupying space? Pope Francis said something that really got my attention. He said, if you don't live to serve, you don't serve to live. Whoa. If you don't live to serve, you don't serve to live. And Sai Baba has said that if we had all of the power of the universe, all of the wealth available, the greatest skills, talents, and ability, and lack devotion, that is to say love of God, our whole lives would have amounted to zero. Wow. So I believe that we're in the time of a collective and individual wake-up call. So if you look at these various things that are happening on the planet from higher awareness, you can see the first ray work of the destroyer aspect of God, often referred to as Shiva, in action, followed by the second ray work of Vishnu, the builder and sustainer. We, in the Christian world, would refer to the first ray energy as the, quote, Antichrist, and the second ray work of the Christ in the same context. One uproots and destroys, and the other builds and sustains. And then you have the third aspect, which is the human community as a whole, which serves as the aspect of intelligent activity. So without intelligent activity, you don't have anything happening, because the law is everything must be forged and built through human hands and feet. So you'll notice that great destinies are called forward into manifestation, usually by the duress of hard times. Greatness of character is always forged in the fire of adversity. Do remember, things are not always what they seem on the surface. Always there is an overall advancement of human consciousness in the mix. I just love the biblical verse that all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. That's all things, no exceptions. You qualify for grace if you love God and are doing your very best to stay aligned with your higher purpose. That is what produces a divinely orchestrated destiny and future. I often and usually pray over people when I'm praying that they may actualize their highest divine destiny, that they may manifest that. Because we have the ego's way of least resistance, the way of comfort, and just focusing on your own self, your own personal self. And then you have that divine life that calls you to do something beyond the personal, to move into that impersonal sense of kinship and compassion and love that sees all as one family, that recognizes that every individual is like a pearl strung on the strand of one divine source. The Course of Miracles said that God only has one son, and that's you and me and everyone. Have some tea with that, why don't you? That means that whoever you see is an incarnation of your own self. Take that for a radical shift in consciousness. Everyone you see is an incarnation of you. God only had one son, and that's you and me and everyone. We are the Christ, the uniquely begotten Son of God, referred to in the Course of Miracles by Jesus as the collective sonship. These are thoughts which, if you contemplate them, will produce such a radical enlightenment of your consciousness that it could change you forevermore. So, my drastic change came when I told my mom I couldn't waste my time anymore being a child, that I had a mission. And Jesus gave me my mission when I was 5 years old, when I gave my life to him, and I asked him how I could serve him. And he said, help troubled people find God. And so I began straight away. But part of my leap of faith and shifting my own life, which was very pleasant, I had a fantastic mother. I had a truly great father. I had a loving and wonderful home. I was spoiled and pampered. I was an only child. I wanted for nothing. But I had a tremendous call of God on my life that I had sensed, since I took my first breath, I knew I was here to serve, to help. So, circus life was far from easy. Remember, it was the 50s. There were no freeways or air conditioning, no cell phones, no TV, no media, no nothing, really. We lived in trailers, as mobile homes were then called. Many people crowded in tight spaces, and we had absolutely no comfort whatsoever. We had lights occasionally, only by generator, no hot water, and no running water in our trailers, and thus no usable toilets. So we had to use the facilities of the fairgrounds or auditorium or wherever the circus was hosted. Or we had the Doniker tent, which was a bathroom tent for the circus. I learned to bathe, wash my hair and my clothes in one bucket of cold water in a tent during winter in Canada. I learned to sleep, dripping in sweat, with relentless flies and mosquitoes dive-bombing my face, to the sound of roaring lions, trumpeting elephants, restless horses, screaming kids, and stakes being hammered into the ground by the roustabouts as the ginormous tent was being raised. During our breaks and our schedules, we rehearsed for hours at a time. I can't remember a time that my body didn't hurt, that I wasn't bandaged with bleeding blisters, that I wasn't wincing with one more push-up, one more chin-up, one more leaping on a horse. It was relentless, and I loved it. At night, when we were in winter quarters, we sewed costumes and spangles and bugle beads on our costumes, like kerosene lamps. And we traveled to a new location every other night when we were on the road, and worked two shows on each weekday and three shows on weekends. We were, in our troupe, 14 people of all ages, 9 horses, and my dog, Tumbleweed. Now, Tumbleweed was a trip. He was a trip because he loved nothing better than rolling in lion feces. And if you think cat poop stinks, well, it's nothing compared to lion poop. It's sort of like skunk oil. You can't really get it, the stink out of the dog's fur. I think we finally used tomato juice or something like that. I know we would bathe that dog until I'm surprised he still had hair and skin left. But stink, oh my Lord, he could spot lion feces no matter how, you know, no matter what he had to go through to get to them. He would invariably find them and roll in them. Anyway, all said, I just loved my years in the circus, and chose that lifestyle over that very cushy life and loving home I had with my mother. In fact, my mom was such a good sport, she even purchased an Airstream trailer and came on the road with me for a year in 1955. She was a real trooper, and everyone just adored her. Now, personally, I have to say, I was terribly insecure. I was one of the youngest people in the circus. There was one other boy who was 14. And aside from the Walenda children, Tino and Delilah, that I helped to raise because I was engaged to their father. And most of you remember hearing, if not seeing, Nick Walenda, who walked across the Grand Canyon on the high wire, and Niagara Falls, and between two skyscrapers in downtown Manhattan. Well, his mother, Delilah, was one of the children of Alberto Zopay, and she was 19 months old when I joined the circus, and her brother, Tino, let's see, when I joined the Zopay Act, not the circus, but the Zopay Act in 1955, and her brother, Tino, was 4 years old. So I kind of helped raise them. Now, if I had married Alberto, I would have been Nick Walenda's step-grandfather. That's how interesting life can get, how weird it can get. So I was extremely insecure, frightened, and abysmally lonely. But I would never let my mother know that, because I definitely did not want her to, you know, take me home. So one circus we were touring with, I don't even remember the name of it now, went bankrupt. And we ended up stranded in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania during the winter. We had only flour and water pancakes to eat, and they were plain and horrible tasting. My shoes had holes in the soles, and it was cold and snowy. And I remember that I bathed in the nearby river. I don't remember it being terribly hard either, because I've always had a sense of the presence of God with me, always. And I've always really enjoyed life and nature and beauty, and I've always kind of lived in my own world. So what I remember was the beauty of the water and how crisp the air smelled and how, you know, after the initial shock of the cold water, how wonderful it felt and how refreshing. Anyway, back to the story. We had no food for a while. Our act, because we were actually the wealthiest act in the circus, we still had some resources. So for a while, we were the ones that took care of the animals and the people, but we were getting to the end of our resources too. So one day, we found ourselves in a very desperate situation. But that was a day that we looked out and saw a long line of cars and trucks headed our way. And the word had spread of our plight. And the townspeople of Stroudsburg and the farmers of the adjacent areas were coming to our rescue with food for us and food for our animals. We had 9 horses, and as I recall, I think there were lions and elephants, and there may have been some bears. But I still remember to this day the taste of that first meal after days of hunger and those flour and water pancakes. And so the show went on, regardless of weather, injuries, hardships, births and deaths. We worked together as performers, representing many nations. There were, I don't recall, any Americans. Sometimes there was an American flying act, that would be flying trapeze, but generally the performers represented Middle Eastern nations. But we all worked as one unit, all in one accord for a united purpose. And when we traveled, we always traveled so that we looked out for one another when we were on the road. If anyone was seen off to the side, we would stop and help them repair their vehicle or whatever. And I remember Mama Zope, when we would pull over to the side of the road for lunch, she'd get out of her, by the way, she looked very much, I hate to tell you, but she looked very much like a chimpanzee with high heels. I kid you not. That was what she looked like. And she and most of the family passed away now, so I can say that without offending anyone. But she would get out of the trailer with this big butcher knife and a brown paper bag. And she looked menacing to begin with. But she really looked scary when she would emerge from the trailer along the side of the road. And she would cut dandelions along the side of the road, dandelion greens. And she would take Italian bread and slice it and put dandelion greens and garlic on it, and that would be our lunch. And she fed, I remember she fed the whole family, and very well, with scraps that normally the butchers would throw away. But she had a way of making the food taste so good that even though she had very little, she spent very little money, really. I think in those days she spent about $10 a week for food. But I remember she made fantastic soup out of chicken feet and chicken heads with the comb and the beak and the eyes and the whole thing. But it was delicious. And then she'd use tripe, which is stomach lining, and, you know, the tails and the ears and stuff of various creatures. But she had a way of making everything taste so good. But anyway, she is one of those people I remember with great fondness, because she was always complaining bitterly in Italian over my relationship with her son. And you can imagine how funny that was. But anyway, so I'm one of these people who's always sensed the presence and grace of God in my life. And during my circus years, I'd often be interviewed on radio and later on TV. And often I'd be asked if I wasn't afraid of doing such dangerous aerial work and traveling alone without my family. And I'd always get the same reply, that I always sensed the hand of God on my head. And years later, in 1973, when in Bombay or Mumbai, I had my 5,000-year-old Book of Bhrigu reading, the records read that God's hand was on my head and he was blessing me. And that was said in reference to my guru, Sai Baba. And yes, his divine hand has always been on my head, protecting and guiding me throughout my life. I remember twice when my rigging hadn't been put up properly, and I was warned in a waking vision that, you know, about the what was going to happen with my rigging. And because of the vision I was given, I was able to warn the people so that the inevitable accident or death that I would have experienced was superseded by their remedying the, the misaligning of the rigging, which is rare in the circus, because generally it was Carl Walenda that checked all of the rigging, and he was very, very good. And but the circus is an interesting life, because you never know when it's going to be your last. And when I was a performer, we did not have any safety regulations in place that they have today. Today, if you work 10 feet off the ground, you have to have what is called a mechanic. A mechanic is a belt around your waist that's attached to a wire that's attached to a pulley, so that if you fall, you can be hoisted in the air and not hit the ground. That was not the case when I was in the circus. Aside from learning initially to ride a horse standing up in Roman riding, we didn't use a mechanic. It was just for beginning when you were learning how to stand on the horse. But after you learned that, you didn't have any safety equipment at all. The Walendas, many of them fell. Unfortunately, that's why they're called the Flying Walendas, because many of my dear, dear, dear friends that I grew up with and worked with and loved very much fell to their deaths, because the Walenda family did what was called a seven-high pyramid, which was absolutely breathtaking. And my teenage girlfriend, Carla Walenda, Carl Walenda's daughter, who is still alive and still performing, she's a couple years older than me, she would stand on a chair on the very pinnacle of that seven-person pyramid and rock the chair back and forth, which was positioned on this little tiny bar. It was the scariest thing you ever saw in your life. And they did that show after show with no net. And so that's why they died, you know, when they fell, which was what changed, actually, the law, so that now you have to have a mechanic around your waist on that pulley, or you have to have a net if you're a flying trapeze artist or any aerialist that works above the ground. One time I almost fell to my death. I was working about 60, 75 feet above a concrete floor in one auditorium, and I was working on a little thin half moon made out of aluminum. And I was sitting on it, and I had one little handhold that I could reach up to and hold. And as I went to change positions and reach for the handhold, instead of grabbing it, I pushed it forward and lunged forward on the moon, which began to rock back and forth violently. There was nothing really to hold on to. It was thin. It was aluminum. It was slippery. And I looked down, you know, that cement floor below with all of the ring curb and the various things that are there. And by God's divine grace, I was able to stop the rocking of the moon, grab the handhold, and continue my act. But it was scary. And if I had fallen, that would have been undoubtedly the end of me. So you just never know in the circus. But circus people are very, very spiritual. Most of them are Catholic. I was a practicing Catholic at the time. We always went to Mass on every Sunday. And we always crossed ourselves before we went into the ring. You would see the performers doing that. They would all make the sign of the cross before they would enter the ring, because you just never know. You live with a thought of your mortality or your potential to be crippled every time you enter that ring. And I used to think, you know, you really have to be kind of crazy to do this for a living. And it's such an interesting thing that the children in the circus, they grow up doing it, and they don't think anything of it. I remember Alberto's little four-year-old boy, would stand on his father's head, and his father would have this, like, patent leather greased hair, you know. In the 50s, they used to use that Brill cream, you know, make your hair really shiny. And the little boy would stand on the top of his dad's hair with that big wave with the grease on it, with nothing holding him. I mean, his dad had one hand on his, you know, the back of his one of his legs. But if he had fallen, I mean, Alberto probably would have caught him. But just saying, the little boy had no fear. And I remember when he hit 6 years old, one day he looked at his dad and he said, "Daddy, I'm afraid. I don't want to stand on your head." And Alberto looked at him with this look like, "What do you mean you're afraid?" He couldn't understand that all of a sudden the little boy became conscious of fear and the possibility of being hurt. But it was very interesting because, you know, when circus kids play, they always play circus. They announce their acts and then they go ta-da and they take their bow and then they enact, you know, enact. Just like, you know, kids would play cowboys, I suppose, if they were children of cowboys. Or rock stars, if they were children of rock stars. But what an amazing world to grow up in. What a wonderful training for me to develop the personal discipline that I would later need to live in India in the ashram of Sai Baba. Oh, and, you know, also I danced in a dance company for 5 years. At one point in my life. So most of my early life was all about physical discipline, overcoming physical pain, working as a member of a group where every member in the team was necessary to pull off the act. It was doing the hard things when you don't feel like doing it. He was pushing through all of the inertia and resistance that the lower nature can come up with. That later became a wonderful assistance to me as I lived in Sai Baba's ashram, which again was about the same as living in the circus in terms of hardships. And definitely not very fun as your body gets older. But I just wanted to say that bottom line, change and upheaval is often the best catalyst for a brighter future. And our destiny is best forged during adversity, in the crucible of life. because we usually do not reach beyond our present conditions unless forced to by change. So if you'd like to do reflect upon your life, perhaps your worst heartbreaks, perhaps the death of a loved one, a divorce, a miscarriage, something, perhaps your house burned down. When I was 6 weeks old, our home burned down, and I was thrown out of a two-story window, wrapped in bedding, to someone who was standing on a roof who caught my body. My father had severed an artery in his arm, breaking the window, and since the bedding was covered with blood, everyone assumed that I was dead. And I was quiet because I was in shock from the being thrown out the window. And it was my cry as a baby that awakened the family, that actually ultimately saved the family. But everything in your life is there as a beckoning to a higher consciousness, a higher understanding of life, and a greater valuing of the preciousness that this brief span between birth and death in each individual form gives us. Each lifetime is much like a chapter in the book of an endless life that you share with God. It's meaningful, it's significant, and it's precious. And this lifetime, more than any others that we've ever had, is the time to move into God realization and manifest our highest divine destiny and work with our brothers and sisters throughout the world to birth the seventh golden age. And this is the time, as we speak, within a very short, by 2025, we're going to see a different world outpicturing. But it will be through our efforts. It will be as soon as we each catch the vision and work in whatever capacity we're called towards this great manifestation. So I hope this has been helpful to you. It's sure been fun sharing it. Let's go out chanting the sacred mantra, Anai Hu, which is another way of saying, I'm another you. Deep breath. Blessings and grace to each one of you. Baruch Hashem Adonai. Blessed is the name of the Lord. Namaste.